Welcome to the Agile Book Club. You're your hosts, Justina and Paul.
So, idea. I talked about the idea of having an after show. The best thing about an after show is it's pretty exclusive. It's out there in the world forever, you know, just like anything else you put on the internet. So conceivably, someday millions of people might find it, but that would mean that millions of people were paying us $5 a month. So I could live with that. So it can be a little bit different. And specifically, I thought it might be fun to use the after show for some of the
things that we really hated about the book.
No. I was thinking that the after show could be, well, obviously it can be whatever it is, because the show is the show, and the show is what it is. What happens here happens in the show, and it's in the show, and it's all in the show, and that's the show. I was thinking, for example, we could talk about, okay, I'm just going to say it. We could talk about Daniel Vacanti's presentation. Because I've got things to say about that presentation that I don't necessarily want to be broadcast out to everyone anonymously listening out there. But I still want to say them.
Yes. That was one of the things that I wanted to cover today in the banter, but I also had the feeling that maybe it's not the best to go worldwide with it. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, we can do that.
All right. So that'll be like that, a little dangler. Little lure. I don't know. Carrot. Whatever. So, hello.
Hi. Hello. Oh. Whenever you are so energetic, I am like, hi.
Am I oppressing you? Are you oppressed? Do you feel oppressed? Is my personality oppressive?
If yes, I have to blink.
It's a podcast. They can't see you and they won't help.
Yeah.
Okay, so should I turn it down a little bit? Welcome to another episode of the Agile Book Club podcast. I'm sitting here today with author and podcaster Justina Pendel, and we're going to be talking today about books.
And I'm not going to laugh, because this is a very serious podcast led by very serious hosts. And we know that laughing, it's not the sign of being serious and respected employee, agile coach, Kanban trainer. So we are going...
It's not professional.
It's not professional.
It's like a doctor going to the beach and taking a picture of herself in a bikini and putting it on Instagram. How can you ever trust her to do medicine again, you know?
Seriality? Yes, it's gone.
We lose all credibility if we laugh.
Exactly.
Bad podcasters. Maybe good podcasters, but bad agile podcasters? No laughing? I don't get it. So anyway, there's something I wanted to talk about before we get into the book today, because Justin and I had an experience last week, and we kind of talked about it before it happened in the last episode when I went on my little rant about how I hate online events. But we went to one. I mean, went. I was sitting on my living room floor covered in cats, because that's what happens when you sit on the living room floor with my microphone on mute, watching sessions, but yeah, we went to an online conference, and, you know, I kind of liked it. What did you think?
You know, I was a little bit overwhelmed with the first email that I got with the setup, because it looked like a lot of work had to be put it in, and I was not sure, you know, how to use everything. I had a problem with downloading the app and installing and stuff. But to be honest, the experience itself, it was better than I expected. And I attended only two talks, because that was just kind of a busy day for me. And of course, I attended Daniel Vacanti talk. And that was really one of the best talks I ever heard. And it really made my day. I went for a walk with just a phone looking at Daniel Vacanti, you know, around the park and just laughing to it. So yeah, that was a really nice one.
You know what I liked? I had first thought when I heard that they were using this... Sococo mm-hmm. app, that the conference was happening entirely inside the Sococo space. So yes. You would actually literally go into the room in which the talk was happening, and then you'd be listening to the talk over Sococo. The way they did it, I thought, was rather clever. Sococo was more of the networking space, and it was running all the time. And I think a lot of the attendees weren't there, which is fine. If there were 1,000 people listening to the talks on Zoom, if there are 1,000 people listening to the talks on Zoom, but only 150 in Sococo, then it just feels like a 150-person conference. So that's fine. So you'd go and you'd listen to the talks that were being streamed live on Zoom, and they were all smooth and flawless and sounded really good. And one of the things I like, I hadn't thought about this, but, you know, you watch conference talks on YouTube or Vimeo or what have you, and you're stuck with the format that the editor gives you. And it's one of three formats, and I hate them all. There's the one where there's a camera in the back of the room, a single camera, usually not a very good one. And so you've got the washed out slides dominating the space in the backs of a bunch of people's heads, and the presenter too tiny to really see their face, just walking back and forth because they all pace for some reason. Then you've got the picture in picture, and it goes one of two ways. Either you've got the tiny little presenter in the corner with the slide dominating the space, which I find to be really helpful when I want to look at the slide, but 95% of the time, I don't want to look at the slide. I want to look at the presenter. Then you've got the other format where the presenter is huge and the slide's in a tiny little box, which is great when you want to look at the presenter, except that 5% of the time when you want to see what's on the slide and it's too small. And using Zoom to do this thing in real time allows you to switch back and forth between the two views on your own. So I found myself doing that, minimizing the slides so I could make eye contact with the presenter and see whether they were sweating or not, you know, that kind of thing. Like, are they really passionate about this? Is the sweat forming on their upper lip? That's important. You need to see that. And then when they're referring...
Okay. I have a new definition. Detail. Okay. Yeah. I know, you have a reason for everything, Paul. Yeah.
So, and then whenever they would make a reference to this tiny little slide up in the corner that maybe had more data on it that I could see in that size, I could just click on it, would become full screen. So I found that to be nice. But what did you think of Sococo?
It was a little, the user interface was not so easy for me. And it was better to build interactions than other tools that I used. But still, it cannot replace the real interactions for me.
Oh, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. But some funny things happened. The way it works is there's a visualization, a map, and you can see different rooms, and the rooms are labeled, and so you can hang out in common spaces. But anytime you go into a room, then you find yourself in a video voice chat with everyone who's in that room. And so I hung out a bit in the flight levels space because I want to hear what people are saying about flight levels, and I know the people there, and I feel comfortable in that space. But something funny happened. Troy McGinnis gave a fabulous talk, as he always does. And afterwards, we went into the room where he was talking to people after the talk and such. And he had people come in and ask him questions and such, and then they all left. But he was, like, booked to be there for an hour. Like, in the schedule, he was in this room available for an hour. And people came in, they were talking to him about his presentation after the presentation. But after about, like, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, just like happens in a real conference, they drifted off to go do other things. And he's stuck in this room for another hour. And I'm in there thinking, you know, I like Troy. He's kind of a friend of mine. I don't want to leave. Right, because I know that he's actually at home and he's comfortable and such, but still he's got to be in this virtual room. And so he and I had this kind of funny, awkward conversation in which we would frequently tell each other, you know, you can leave, but it was cute. So it wasn't nearly as interactive as in a real conference, but it beat the, what is the rating on this podcast? Heck. Because I think we've got a no swear words rating. It beat the heck out of those online events that are nothing but back-to-back,
yes,
one-way streaming video.
Yeah, definitely. I really appreciated amount of effort that Jose and JP, they put it into organizing the conference. Really, kudos to them. And I wouldn't be able to do that. I have no idea how they did it in such a short time, because it was, to be honest, a short time since they decided to run the online conference now, not in the December as it was at the beginning. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. They had all these tools, and they worked, and they were all described very carefully. Mm-hmm. And they had activities to get people comfortable with them. They had contests and scavenger hunts in the Sococo space. I lost. Yeah. They did give me a 50% discount to a professional Kanban course, and I'm tempted to take it. If I really want to know all about professional Kanban, I can probably just talk to Dan, unless he listens to the after show today, in which case he may never talk to me again. But I could just talk to Dan, but I'm thinking maybe I've got time, half price, see how somebody else teaches Kanban. Because mm-hmm. as Kanban trainers, we train Kanban all the time, but we very rarely actually get to see how other people do it. Maybe like Radek and I sometimes co-train. So I learned a lot from him seeing the way that he teaches the same things. But I think that since learning Kanban myself from David Anderson, Radek might be the only Kanban trainer I've actually ever seen teaching Kanban in a class. Mm-hmm. So it might be fun not only to take, I think it's Jose and JP are probably going to be teaching it. I'd love to see them training because they're great trainers and they're training from the back of the room trainers. But it's also going to be brand new material. I mean, it's based on concepts that we both already mm-hmm. know intimately, but it's got to be different enough to not be a... Is it a copyright violation? What is it when a trainer takes one trainer's material and repurposes it? I don't know. Bad.
Yeah. Stealing intellectual property, copyrights.
Yes, absolutely. And so...
Being inspired.
Mm-hmm. So somebody has sat down and they have put together a whole new introduction to Kanban that's not based on the way that we used to teach Kanban, and I'm kind of curious about it. Why not?
Why not? Exactly.
So, shall we get to the meat?
Yes.
What are we talking about today?
Today we are going to talk about Lisa Atkins' book, Coaching Agile Teams. And it was the book that many people recommended to me for years. It's the book that is on the market for almost, I think, 10 years. And I feel, of course, shame that I didn't read it before. I know that I should. But you know how it is with all the things that you should do. It's sometimes taking you a little bit too long. But to be honest, I'm happy that I finally did it. Because that was interesting read for me. It is not the book that you can read within one or two or three sittings. I found it really interesting to actually read it for 2 weeks, taking a few pages and then having some thoughts going back to work and see, you know, how those thoughts are formulating in my head. How can I respond maybe differently? So I was like reading and experimenting with myself and my own responses. So that was really interesting 2 weeks for me. But there was also one thing that I liked about the book, that it is not aimed clearly or specifically only at the agile coaches who just became agile coaches and they always wanted to be agile coaches, but it's aimed also for people who transform from, for example, like Liz Atkins, from a command control manager, or maybe from the developer, from a scrum master, from the different kind of roles, that actually the agile coaching, being agile coach is for everyone. If only you work, maybe not only, because there's a lot of things that you have to work on and it's very, very hard. But I mean that this is the path that a lot of people can go if they feel that they have something in common, that this is the direction that they want to follow and evolve. So that was really interesting for me. And I also like the structure. So Coaching Agile Teams was 302 pages of content divided into three sections. The first one was It Starts With You, which kind of started with an obvious question, will I be a good coach? What does it really mean? What is the path of being the good coach? And it was the part of the book when you could learn a little bit about yourself. Of course, some of the things were, I would say, a little bit shallow, because, you know, you cannot learn about yourself in one section of the book. But I think that was a good start for a lot of people to start thinking about it. And the second section was helping the team to get more for themselves, which I really found it useful, especially with a lot of tools for how to facilitate planning session, retrospective. There was a lot of Scrum artifacts explained and with some exercises and other body of knowledge that you could go to. And the last one was getting more for yourself. in which I found one very interesting concept when it comes for the failure mode and success mode. So there was like a lot of new things that I didn't read before, or maybe just read very briefly, but I really appreciated coming back to it. So that is basically my long elevator pitch. I'm happy that I started as the first one because I had a lot of to say.
So that was your elevator pitch? Wow. How many floors in that building?
There's not such a high building in Poland, I guess.
Okay, so...
Or star pitch, you know? Like star speech.
How do I follow that? I thought about my elevator pitch too, and I would start out by saying, it's a shame I have to recommend this book to anyone. It was written 10 years ago, and I read it when it first came out. And also, our profession is almost 20 years old, and the word coach is right there in the title. And yet, the number of people who find themselves to this day, and I think I mentioned this on a previous podcast like about a month ago, which is that even these things that we just take for granted because we've been doing them for so long, every single day, somebody comes to work and has a boss who says, I want you to be the Scrum Master from now on. So we've got brand new Scrum Masters, brand new Agile coaches starting every single day. And there's no reason why a person who's been a programmer for the last 10 years should have grabbed this book 10 years ago, because they were just a beginning PHP programmer, and now they just found out that they know more about Agile than anybody else, and so they've just been put into this role. And so there are always going to be Agile coaches who don't know much at all about coaching, because coach is an unusual path to Agile coach. There are some examples in this book, and I thought that was great. People who came into Agile coaching from being a different kind of coach, a sports coach or a life coach. Mm-hmm. But that's uncommon. Most people don't come into Agile coaching knowing coaching first and learning Agile second. They learn the Agile first, and maybe someday they learn to coach. And this is a great introduction to it. There are a couple of caveats that I have. No, I'm not going to get into that. So yeah, if you're an Agile coach, if you're becoming an Agile coach, regardless of what you call it, it might be called Agile Project Manager, Agile Coach, Scrum Master, whatever, maybe just team lead of a team that wants to do Agile. Whatever it is, if coaching is part of what you perceive to be your job, I would recommend this book, despite the fact that it will probably scare the hell out of you. Because coaching is big. Coaching is a big discipline, and you're never really done with it. But the thing that really grabbed me is that the front cover of this book, almost 10 years ago, Liz Adkins wrote a book on Agile coaching, and the forewords were written by Jim Highsmith and Mike Cohn. If Jim Highsmith and Mike Cohn, and blurbs from folks like Rachel Davies and Chris Avery, if these people think you should read the book, then why are you even bothering with my opinion? You should read the book. So, those are elevator pitches. Takeaways. What were some of your takeaways after reading this book?
One of the takeaways actually jumped to me at the beginning of the book when Lisa was sharing her story of being the command control manager. And then there was a section in which she was listing some kind of behaviors when the orange lamp was turning on that she's having again this command control mode. And I think that it's not only for those managers, but also for people who like to have things under control. And I'm one of them, and I'm trying to fight with that. You know, I was always thinking that this is a good quality to have, that you solve the problems before they appear and that you are like, you know, taking the ownership. But I think it depends also on the position. So there are a few things that she listed to keep eye on them. If you are this kind of a person or this kind of the coach at the beginning. And the first one is actually don't be afraid of uncomfortable silence. And I think that's super hard, especially right now when we are all working remotely. I think the silence became even more uncomfortable than ever when it's like in the online experience. So I think that this is a huge challenge when it comes for the agile coaching right now, these days, to let the silence be there. The other thing was to take it to the team. So don't jump into solving the problem first. And again, it's something that I know that sometimes I'm saying about books through my own perspective. I hope that I don't bore the listeners, but I will a little bit. But of course, this is something that Paul told me once, that your solution is might be the second one in the room. The first, as an agile coach, scrum master, you take the problem to the team because they have the capacity, they have the knowledge that you, even with your best interest and trying, you might not have. So trust the team that they can take care of that. They can come up with a solution. And the third one, risky behavior for the recovering command control manager was actually being afraid for team to fail because you feel responsible for that. And this is what Lisa was saying, that it was also hard for her. And whenever she was finding herself in solving the problems for the team, because she was not like afraid of her reputation, but felt that this is kind part of her reputation, was also tough for her and also for those command control manager. And the fourth thing that those recovering command control managers should learn is to actually to be the biggest fan of a team. To not only, you know, say, here is your carrot and you are doing great and this is your annual bonus, but actually be there for team, cheer them, but not in this, you know, empty way of just, oh, well done, great job. Yes. So those are the four aspects that Lisa actually listed out when it comes for the recovering control managers. What should they be careful? Because those are the most popular patterns that they can fall into.
I really enjoyed that section where she was talking about being the advocate for the team, loving the team, which we, of course, Ryan Ripley talked about a lot as well. It resonated with me because what was interesting about it is it wasn't empty optimism. It was a kind of tough love because she didn't just talk about being the cheerleader for the team. She talked about expecting extremely good performance from them, even though they weren't there yet. Mm-hmm. Knowing, like believing deep down that they are capable of incredible things. And if you actually really believe that people are capable of incredible things and they're not delivering incredible things, then you're living with this gap. Mm-hmm. Which you can fill that gap with a lot of things. The most natural thing to fill that gap with is resentment or disgust. But no, that's mean. But you know, if you realistically expect a very high standard from someone or from a team and they're not delivering to that standard, it would be natural to fill that space with disappointment. And so the way she had written it, I can't remember exactly how she said it, but the impression that I got is that she fills that space with hope and excitement and expectation and growth and, well, her job, coaching. Mm-hmm. That space is not a condemnation. That space is an opportunity.
Yeah, it is why I think it's very hard to be an agile coach. Like, it really takes time to actually know, take the first reaction that so often comes to us, which is like a little bit disappointment when you know that people are capable of something and it's not how you kind of imagine it, even though it's not about your vision. But I think it's a natural sometimes response that we struggle with as human. Paul, any takeaways from you?
Nope, none.
We just started.
I've got tons of takeaways, but there's something I have to get kind of off my chest first.
I take my headphones off.
And it's this. When I recommend a book, and you've heard me do this before, and I'm going to do it again. When I recommend a book, I need to be careful that I'm not giving it just a blanket approval that everything in here is great. And there is in this book something that I've noticed in other books that were written by people who had a grounding in Scrum have done, and that is that, now granted, this was written in 2009, and in 2009, all of the things that she says about Scrum were true. But Scrum has changed since then. And so if you're new to Scrum and you're new to Agile coaching, and this is one of the first books that you're reading, a couple of things to be careful of are, back in 2009, the way we did Scrum is that our goal was to get a stable, predictable, and improving velocity and get really good at estimating so that we could pull items from the backlog to build a sprint backlog that we could actually complete. And that is no longer the way it's described in the Scrum Guide anymore. That's not the way it's practiced anymore because there's too much variability in the systems in which we work. and because it goes against the idea of always being open to change. Instead, it's being replaced, and it has been replaced for the last several years, with this idea of a sprint goal. There's a goal that we're trying to accomplish. We have a planning meeting to try to decide how we build a backlog to accomplish that goal. But the goal remains more important than the backlog. And so if during the sprint you learn a better way to accomplish the goal than the one that you planned, making changes is fine. The important thing is to accomplish the goal that you set for yourself, which could be creating a particular new experience or allowing people to do something they couldn't do before or solving a business problem as well as you possibly can or something like that. So that's the first one. She talks about commitment in at least 3 or 4 different places in this book, and it's all based on an older understanding of the way commitment works in Scrum. And the other is that when she wrote this book in 2009, now mind you, Mary and Tom had published their book, but I don't think it's been as influential as the rise of Kanban and the Kanban community and the Kanban training programs and such. But when she wrote this book, David Anderson was, I think, just starting to talk publicly about Kanban, and so it hadn't made an impact yet. And so there are a couple instances in this book in which she talks about the importance of making sure that people have multiple skills and they learn how to step in and take responsibility for different parts of a project work than they might normally do, specifically so that they can maximize their utilization. She says in 2 places in the book, in 1 place she says that the trade-offs should be as instantaneous as possible because waiting is waste. And what we know from years and years and years of working with flow-based approaches is that when you're dealing with variability, you need buffers, and buffers mean some waiting time. Eliminating all buffers means you've created some kind of a mechanical process, which is not the world that we live in. And the second instance is when she says that people should take on other roles so that they can maximize their utilization, so they can contribute as much as possible to the team. And because also of all of these people who have been doing a lot of work with Kanban, we now know that if every single member of a team is busy, they are inefficient. Because when everybody is busy, there's no one available to take on the important work as it becomes available, and so you're creating more queues unnecessarily. So you need to have a little bit of slack in the system in order to focus on flow instead of focusing on resource utilization. So with just those 2 things to keep in mind, otherwise, everything in this book you can take is as incredibly valuable and useful to your coaching career.
So what was the first incredibly useful thing?
I'm going to skip towards the back of the book for one of the biggest takeaways, because there are a lot of little takeaways. There was a lot of tools that I might have known about and certainly read about when I read the book the first time that I've forgotten about and have never used, and now I read about them now. I'm thinking I should have been using these tools. But I think probably the biggest thing is if you read nothing else in this book at all, read the chapter on conflict. It is dense and rich and useful and necessary, and it's fabulous the way that I think it might be one of the most insightful parts of the book is this very rich chapter on types of conflict and conflict models and why conflict is good and how to talk about different kinds of conflict and how to help teams deal with conflict. And I don't want to give away the content, but so I'm not going to go into too much detail, but it is the single best resource on conflict management inside of a team that I've ever read.
That's true, and that was actually one of my takeaways. I was planning to go into detail, but I'm not going because you said that we are not going. But I will just add one more thing, that she didn't only just listed 5 types of conflict, but she even gave the type of a conversation, the language that you can observe in this kind of conflicts, and the ideas on how you can deal with that, the ideas of the potential risks, and some kind of guidance on when you should get into the conflict, engage, and when you should just kind of let it happen because it's not a disaster. It's like human system. It's more complex. You cannot say like we are not going to argue, because I think it was also said in one of the books that we reviewed, the worse than a bad relation is no relation. So the conflict is also the sign that people care about something, are passionate about it.
Okay, so you did it, so I'm going to share something too that I really liked, and that is she was talking about research on marriages, and...
Yes.
I've been married for 20 years now, and so I know a little bit about it. And one of the things that she pointed out is that in a marriage, like 60% of the problems that plague a marriage never go away. They're kind of, they're baked in. They're fundamental aspects of the personalities of the people involved. And so if 60% of the marital issues, the challenges that your marriage faces, never go away, then how do you overcome them? And the answer is you don't. The difference between marriages that succeed and marriages that fail is marriages that succeed don't eliminate the negative bits. They just have more positive bits to offset it. And the same kind of thinking can apply to a team. The goal of coaching a team in dealing with conflict is not to eliminate conflict. It's to make sure that the conflict is healthy, not unreasonably high levels of conflict, but also to make sure that the conflict doesn't become the dominant part of the team's experience, in which people are getting up in the morning thinking, oh heck, I've got to go to work and I have to work with these people and it's going to be terrible. So one approach to dealing with that is to just create more positivity. If most of your interactions with a person are fabulous, except for the occasional ones that are negative, then you can still have a good working relationship with that person. But if you take all the fabulous ones away and just keep the same number of negative interactions, that person becomes the bane of your existence. Mm-hmm. So I like that observation. I like the idea. It's also very positive when you're going into a challenging situation to think about, how do I solve these problems? How do I fix these people? Which is a terrible way of thinking about coaching. Sorry, I put that out there. But how do I help these people deal with this conflict? And just focusing on the conflict is so limiting if you're also thinking positively, like, how can I bring more joy? And not just joy, but joy, excitement, enthusiasm, laughs, successes. Because, okay, I'm going to break my rule and say one more thing, which is that sometimes the best thing you can do for a team in conflict is to just help them work well, just do their jobs well. Because one of the things that she said here is that, and I'll try to remember as well as I can, is that the relationships between people are more a function of how well they're performing at work than how well they're performing at work is a function of how well they relate to each other. So if you get a group of people who maybe don't have a lot in common, maybe don't even like each other that much personally, maybe they have some disagreements, but they are really proud of what they're doing, that will have a bigger impact on those relationships. And they'll enjoy working together, even though stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as you mentioned, the conflict was kind of essential chapter of the book, and that was also my key takeaway. And the second one I briefly touched at the beginning when I was saying about those command control behaviors, but I would like to just dig into that a little bit more. So there was one sentence that said, don't solve the problem before team realize that. And that's again something that I was, for example, taught during my university years, that it's a great skill if you can, like, you know, predict the problem, solve the problem. You know, we are having, being a problem fixing person, it's a great quality. And I was always having this kind of the thinking, but of course I'm trying to get rid of that. But what Lisa suggested in the book was 4 steps on what you can do in the problem situation. So the first one is you detect the problem. You see that there is a problem, but instead of like jumping into the solution, you pause. You really take a pause. You reflect on the problem. You try to see it clearly. You try to see it in the bigger picture. You don't focus on the single problem. You try to see it. How does it play out in the system? Where does it come from? Is it connected with something else? You try to kind of build a bigger picture with the problem. The third one is, of course, you take the problem to the team. And the fourth one is to allow the team to act or not, because not all the problems has to be solved. And it's something that it's connected with what you, Paul, said before, that there are some things in relationships, in the team dynamic that are problematic, but they are not going to be solved because it's like impossible, but we can balance them with the happy things. So those four steps on how you can deal with a problem when you are having this problem-solving spirit and you want to do it. And sometimes I also find it extremely challenging because sometimes the whole environment, they push you to solve the problem because you are the agile coach. You are the most knowledgeable person. You are the most experienced person. So tell us what to do. Tell us, you know, you should tell us. And the pressure that it's on you, I even feel it right now when I'm in the Scrum Master position and I don't want to solve all the problems because I want the team to learn, but I feel the pressure that goes on you to solve, to help, to say what to do and how to do. And it's so hard to resist. But yeah, take a pause, take a deep breath, look into the big picture, take a problem to the team, act or don't act. Not acting, it's also okay.
I think I've shared this story here before on one of my engagements, one of the longer engagements. There was a senior manager who was very knowledgeable about Kanban who came over to one of the teams I was working with, and she was looking at their Kanban board with me and observed that they were breaking WIP limits. And she said, "Why are they breaking WIP limits?" And I said, "Because various reasons, you know, why people break WIP limits. I mean, not good reasons, but various reasons." And she said, "Why are you letting them do that?" And I said, "Because my goal here is to try to develop a team that is self-sustaining. I don't want them to obey WIP limits. I want them to respect WIP limits. And to respect WIP limits, they have to experience for themselves what happens when you disrespect them." So yeah, she talks a lot about problem solving, and I love everything she had to say because it reflects my own teaching and coaching over the years. I might sound like a broken record because I'm sure I mentioned these things in podcasts before, but things like, for example, I think I often quote Mark Twain, who said, "I'm an old man and I've known many troubles in my time, most of which never happened." She says the same things here. A lot of the problems that you as an experienced agile coach see coming up over the horizon never materialize. They just don't happen. And so make sure it's a real problem first. And the other thing is never speak. I mean, it's really a good idea as a coach to every single time something pops into your head to not say it unless you've got a really, really good reason. And she gives two good reasons, both of which require some consideration. So if you've got an idea that pops into your head that you want to give voice to, the two tests, and they come from different parts of the book, are, one, is saying this actually going to be better than not saying it? Mm-hmm. So I think she was quoting somebody else because I've heard this before as well. Think about whether or not the words that you're going to say are better than the silence that's there as the alternative. Because anything can come out of silence. Magical things can come out of silence. But once the thing is said, it's just the thing. And it has a life of its own and can drive discourse in a different direction. But the other one, which I really liked, is think about where it's coming from. And if the thought that's popped into your head is coming from your ego, your desire to show your knowledge, or if it's coming from a place of fear that you won't get the credit, or fear that something might go wrong and you'll get blamed. If it's coming from a bad place, any place that's not a place of compassion for the team, then it probably shouldn't be said. Or at least slept on. She's a big fan of sleeping on things. And I think that's a great idea. I liked one of the things that she said about the people that she's mentoring. When one of the less experienced agile coaches that she's mentoring sends her an email or says, "Can we talk? I've got this big problem." She always says, "Sure, that's absolutely fine," and then schedules it several days away. And it's so tempting when a friend has a problem to you.
Yeah, me.
It's so tempting when a friend has a problem. Yes. I know you. This could be good advice for the same advice that I give to you, Justina. You don't have to be the best friend in the world. It's fine for most people to be the second person that they'd call if they had a problem. being everybody's first person to call is a really rough place to be. And so she says that this way she basically forces them to really think about the problem, attempt to solve it on their own, so that when they do have a conversation about it, it's a much more informed conversation. It's not just her solving somebody else's mm-hmm. problem for them. You've got a lot of notes there. You've got pages and pages.
Yeah, because last time, Paul, you had so much when it comes for the Kanban maturity model.
Well, that was... Yes.
So I decided that this time I will be better prepared and I have like 4 favorite quotes, not 1. You probably have 10 when I have 4.
Yeah, it looks like I have 7 or 8. But you've got a lot of pages there. And you've got to have more takeaways. Can we do a few more? Because I think we've only done like 2 or 3 for each of us.
Yeah, because they just, you know, end up in like a longer conversation. Let me check which one I want. Okay. Another thing that I really appreciate about the book was the section with the failure and the success mode when it comes for agile coaching. Mm-hmm. And I think that naming those kind of behaviors, giving them fun, maybe not the sometimes fun name, sometimes less fun name, can help people to kind of put themselves in some position and notice that this is a kind of like a failure mode. Because, for example, when you think about one of the modes that she describes, the admin, some of the people can think like, okay, you're the agile coach, you know the best, the tools, so you have the knowledge of the project, you know the client, you know everything. So why don't just help and do some middleman activities because they are, for example, stressful or hard for the team? But what you have to be aware of as agile coach, if you do any admin things or too many admin things, you undermine the team's ownership of the problem. You undermine their ownership of the product and other things that are kind of risky. And the other, for example, failure mode, it was kind of a surprise for me, was the expert. Because, for example, I was thinking like being expert, the agile coach that is expert should be like the success. But what she listed, it's that when you're the expert, you are maybe involved in too many details of the teamwork. So you know too much. You have too many opinions. Sometimes you just pose some kind of the questions that shouldn't come from you. They should come from the team. So actually being too involved and knowing too many things about the product and about the project might be, again, risky. And it was something that you told me, Paul, a month ago when you suggested like, what if a Scrum Master, you wouldn't know anything about the project, you wouldn't know anything about the product. Your goal would be only to focus on the interaction and communication. How would you approach that? Yeah. And I thought like, yeah, Paul, that's a great idea, but I should understand. Yes. Because I want to understand to have a better view on what is happening. But now, after seeing that in the book, I kind of see your point where you were taking this conversation. And one more failure mode that I really liked and it brought a smile on my face was the butterfly. And I have to read that one because it was funny. So the butterfly fly around the team from one team to another, landing just long enough to impart a pearl of wisdom or pose a philosophical question. And that was, of course, one of the complaints that I was hearing over the year from a few friends of mine who are working with agile coaches. And they were complaining that they just, you know, come to you, same philosophical questions that you are not capable of answering. And it just, you know, drives you nuts.
Be the water.
Exactly. So seeing the butterfly, it just immediately, you know, gave me a name of kind of a behavior that I've seen, that I heard of. So those are the failure modes that I think that you should read and be aware of them, because naming the things can help you to manage them in your own head. Yeah,
you know, that's a pattern that you bring up. That's a pattern that I observed in the book, is that her solution to a lot of these tricky issues is to provide a lexicon for them, to provide a vocabulary. So there's a lot of places in this book where there's like stages of agile.
Yes.
Performance or stages of agile understanding. stages of conflict, different types of failure, different types of success. And it's really hard to identify these things happening or to talk about them until you've got some kind of a vocabulary. And this book is great for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, yes. That's definitely, yeah.
I also really liked the whole chapter on collaboration. Yeah, it starts out by contrasting collaboration to cooperation. And I've seen this before a lot, because cooperation is usually our first goal. You need people to work together, and you're trying to create a healthy, helpful, friendly environment and where people have respect for each other and can work together well. And when you don't have that and you put in place enough practices and enough getting to know you exercises and such, and you start forming a cohesive team, that you achieve a point of cooperation where everybody is just working nicely together, it feels so much better. You can accidentally think you're done. So I really like the way she contrasts that with collaboration. Cooperation is doing your job well and allowing other people to do their job well, not getting in the way, but still it's not really producing more than the sum of its parts. And I like the way that she talks about what collaboration is as being a place in which people are working in a interdependent system that can manifest emergence. And the definition of emergence from a system is when the system is producing something, some behavior, or some output, which you can't pin down to any of its pieces. You can say, this thing is coming out of the system, this is some new phenomenon coming out of the system, but nobody in particular is doing it.
Yeah.
And that just sounds so magical that it's a thing you'd want to pursue if you'd never experienced it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people haven't experienced it before. So that was really nice. That's another one of the really, there's some great chapters in this book, and each one of them is encapsulated. So you can read the book end to end. You can also bounce around in the book, read the chapters that are most interesting to you. And yeah, the collaboration coordination chapter is another one of the highlights for me in this book.
Okay, I have two more, if I may. I think it was the beginning of the book when she mentioned that they are two dimensions on which you coach. The first one is you coach a team, and the second one you coach individual. And what I found extremely useful also was like, when do you do which of them? So for example, the moment of coaching the team, it's at the beginning of the iteration when you are having a planning session, when they need your guidance, when they need your facilitation, when they need you to kind of bridge the collaboration maybe between the product owner and the team and support them. And then at the end of the iteration, when you have the review, retrospective, and all the other things that are actually happening. And the time for the individual coaching is the best, like in the middle of a sprint, because the thing that actually happens, and I also found myself in this situation, was like, okay, maybe I should do something. Maybe I should do something. You know, it's like a middle of a sprint, it's like nothing happening. And then I just told myself, like, does it help a team? Yeah. Does it help the team? They have to have time to work. And you know, I have a lot of friends who are also developers, and they are sometimes complaining about too engaged Scrum Master, too engaged Agile coaches, that there are like so many things happening that they don't have time to work because it's all the time something, all the time talking games and stuff. And even though that appreciate that, they have to have time for work too. So you can use this time as the opportunity to help individuals and take time also for yourself to think. Because what I found in the book was also that as a good agile coach, as a good coach, you have to have time for yourself, for the self-reflection. And also she was another person who suggested having some kind of a journal. Putting your thoughts on paper helps you not only in your private life, but also in your professional life. So yes.
I seem to recall the context for that was how incredibly difficult it is to have conversations about a coach's contributions in a more traditional management culture. And ideally, and this is where it gets kind of scary and off-putting for a new coach, ideally, a team improves and improves and improves as a result of your coaching efforts. And at no point in time can anyone say, this got better because she did that.
Yeah.
and so if you're coaching really well, you can be inspiring or creating an atmosphere for improvement and nobody notices.
Yeah, and that was one of these success mode with like being a magician coach. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So her two pieces of advice on that particular topic are, number one, don't let them pin you down. When they want to talk, if you're in a company that does annual performance reviews, for example, and it's your performance review time, don't let them pin you down to taking credit for actions. Talk about the overall improvement of the team and let them know that you were a big part of that. So you talk about the team, not about your actual initiatives. Like, I saw this problem, I fixed it this way. This person didn't know this thing, I set them mm-hmm. straight. That sort of thing, thinking is what they want from you because it's what they're trained to compensate. Although, kind of off topic, but I saw a really, really apt observation about compensation systems. And it was, people are not paid what the value of their work is worth. People are paid based on how much it costs to replace them. But in any case, they need some kind of a way of deciding how much to pay you. And so when you're having this conversation, keep it about the team. And one way to help build this story, because what's actually happening is a very gradual progression that can be difficult to see, is this approach to journaling that she suggests creates for you a story that you can tell when you're talking to people about your experience working with the team over the course of the last mm-hmm. year. So we've been talking a lot of high-level stuff here about conflict and coaching and this sort of thing, and I don't want to lose sight of the fact that there are a lot of really practical tools in here. So just for example, you've probably heard of some of these, but you probably haven't heard of all of them. Just when it comes to like getting a team started, she talks about a number of different tools you can use depending on the nature of the personalities in the team and their comfort level and such. Things like journey lines, market of skills, constellation, values. The values exercise sounds a lot like what the Management 3.0 does mm-hmm. with the values cards. But she's got a number of just specific exercises. Constellation sounds fun, where you just put the team together in a group and then you just make a statement like, work is one of the primary things I get excited about when I get up in the morning. Or what I like most about my job is collaboration with other people. And people for whom that is very true gravitate towards the center of the room. People for whom that is less true gravitate away from it. And so you create these constellations around ideas and you see how people are different. Or the journey mapping, where people are telling their life story, obviously in a way mostly professional, but in a way that's relevant and that they're comfortable with. Just a number of different exercises. Market of skills was a fun one too. So if what skills would you put up for sale? How would you value them? That kind of thing. And then talking about what skills people need and what skills they have. You know, I want to build this product and I really need a front-end developer. I don't have front-end skills. So that sort of thing. The other is the Fist of Five. And the idea about having really simple ways, when the team is self-organizing around something and they seem to be coming to conclusions and such, you can check to make sure whether or not there's really consensus or it's mostly being driven by a few strong voices and quiet voices are holding back. By doing something like a Fist of Five, you can say, it seems like we're heading towards this solution. If we were to implement this solution, how happy would you be being part of that? If it's you wish it was your idea and it's you're absolutely delighted with it, hold up five fingers. If you think it could probably work and you'd be on board, hold up four fingers. If you think it might not be the best solution but it'd be good enough, hold up three fingers. If you're really kind of concerned about this and you think we should look into something else, hold up two fingers. And if this is something that you will not stand by and allow to happen, hold up one finger. Mm-hmm. And it's done quickly, like paper, rock, scissors, and you instantly find out whether or not what you've been hearing is actually what's happening, whether people are actually reaching a kind of consensus or not. So I found this book is loaded with just tiny little tools and games and exercises like that that can really be useful for fleshing out different aspects of your coaching activities.
Exactly. That's what you needed, Paul. Yes, that's my approval.
It's what I live for.
Yeah.
Okay, so you said earlier that you had two more, which means you now have one more.
Yes. What is it? Yes. It is about the failure, and I kind of started by saying about those failure modes, but also she gave a great section about how to recover from failure and how to learn to live with failure, how to make the failure a part of your life and being happy actually even to fail, because it means that you learn. And she put a great equation into it, which is not very complicated. I know I said equation, I know I said math, but she said trust plus attention equals good coaching, or at least it is a foundation for a good coaching. And I think like a part of creating a safe to fail environment is also being exposed to do failures. As an agile coach, as we learned, you don't have to be the expert. You don't have to be the smartest person in the room. You know, don't position yourself for that. Let yourself to fail. Try to new things. Because I think that sometimes we are afraid of trying new things because we'll fail. And as an agile coach, we shouldn't fail because we should be example for others. And so on and so on. By actually giving yourself a permission to fail and being okay with failing, I think it's a great way on the mastery to become a better agile coach. Yes, Paul, what is your last one? It's the last one, because our listener...
Well, you know, I actually wrote down more, but the last one that I really want to share, just because it really spoke to me and it's not something that I've given enough thought to, is when she was talking about coaching individuals and meeting them a half step ahead. Mm-hmm. So coaching a person is very different than mentoring. You're not designing the journey for them, but you're helping them along the journey. And so if you're going to coach someone, you should have an idea of where they're going and how far along they are on that journey. And it's really tempting to be the owner of that journey. And when you have a coaching session with an individual, to try to help them as far along on the journey as they can and keep the goal in sight and this sort of thing. And I thought it was really grounding and a little frightening to think about this idea of having a coaching session with someone in which you meet them a half step ahead of where they are. Because that means you have to really understand where they are and where they want to go. You don't want to stress them out. You don't want to make the journey seem too long and too difficult. You just want to keep them moving forward. And so there's quite a lot of discussion. I'm not going to go into all of it, but a really nice discussion in this book about this idea of just always meeting them from a place which is challenging and aspirational, but absolutely achievable for them.
Paul, and your last takeaway led me to my favorite quotation, which is, a friend loves you the way you are. A coach loves you too much to let you stay that way.
That is nice. Yep, that was one of mine too, but that's okay. I've got plenty.
Okay.
How about this one? Because it's from reasonably early in the book, but it's kind of really high level and just hits the nail on the head. Coaching starts with you, but it is not about you.
Nailed it.
I don't know. I like the sound of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The other one, agile works when they learn how to rely on one another. It has nothing to do with you looking as a good coach. Mm-hmm. I think it was in the collaboration section that you liked a lot.
But it's so tempting.
Yeah, it's so tempting.
You want your team to succeed. And I have a really rough time keeping my ego out of the room. Something that I've been talking about a lot, and I've given a lot of conference presentations about it, I can't just not bring this up because it was so obvious to me in this book. I give whole conference presentations at agile conferences about nonviolent communication and meditation. And those are two things that are really the cornerstone of her approach to understanding herself and how she interacts with others. And that is exactly what did it for me. Not to say that I've learned to entirely leave my ego at the door when I go to work, but to the extent that I have been able to, it's because of mindfulness meditation and practicing nonviolent communication. And it's really nice to see that this has been a path for others for quite some time now, and it works.
Yes, exactly. And the last quotation from you, Paul.
Last, okay, so, okay. All right, gotta get this out there, just because it's so fun. She was saying at one point that it's, and at one point, she actually says it in many different ways, in different sections throughout this book, the idea that you have to really stretch the boundaries of what's possible. You have to ask the questions that should not be asked, and you have to draw out the ideas that must not be said and such. But the first time that she brings it up, she has a fabulous quotation about just being outrageous. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
And it is this, which is that you can count on them, them being your team, you can count on them to tell you when you're being too outrageous. You can't count on them to tell you that you're not being outrageous enough. Loved it.
Yeah, that's true.
So read the book. It's a good book.
Yes. Long story short, it's a good book. Read the book, yeah. So, Paul, Coaching Agile Teams was my book for this month. So what we are going to read for September?
Well, you know, I was just, I was on the last Flight Club meetup, the online Flight Club meetups. And if you don't know about this, the Flight Levels Academy organizes these regular webinars, and they've been fantastic. And they're all on YouTube, so you can see all of the old ones. And they call them Flight Club. Get it? Flight Levels Flight Club. They happen every Wednesday, and not every Wednesday, every second Wednesday. So every second Wednesday, and I'll put a link to where to find these things in the show notes, but they're really good and educational and have nice people on them. And in the last one, they were talking to Heidi Helfand, who has just written a second edition of a book that she had written a while ago, but now it's revised and sounds like it was a pretty major revision. And I thought it would be relevant because we're dealing right now with a time of a lot of uncertainty and a lot of chaos and a lot of change. And she asked a question that is challenging and rarely asked. We all know, right? I mean, as agile coaches, as agilists and such, we know that the ideal is a stable team that can build strong relationships on a solid foundation of a shared history and develop shared stories and values and such so that they can really gel together as a team. And that is really the ideal. But it can't happen. It can't happen because, here, let me ask you this. Let's say you love your team. You love these people on your team. And one of them gets a fabulous job offer doing what she's always dreamed about, where she can make a real impact in a part of the world that is very meaningful to her. Would you want her to pass that up because she loves the team so much? No. We want the people we care about to grow and expand and explore new territory and learn new things and pursue their careers and hopes and dreams. And this happens. This happens. And so teams change. And with all the talk about the importance of stable teams, nobody has really had the courage to talk about how important is that really? And what should we do about the fact that we can't do anything about that? And Heidi Helfand wrote a book called Dynamic Reteaming, which I did not read. When it came out, I wanted to read it. But at the time, I think at the time that it came out, I was no longer working with teams and I was predominantly engaged in training. So it didn't seem terribly relevant to me at the time. Suddenly it's relevant again. And it's more relevant than ever these days. And so the idea of actually having theory and practical approaches to deal with the inevitability of changes happening in your team in a way that is at worst as non-disruptive as possible and at best as positive as possible. And the possibility even that properly handled reteaming, properly handling changes in a system can be a good thing for the system is really intriguing to me. And so I want to read that book.
I'm convinced.
So, all right. So in 2 weeks, we are going to be talking to Liz Adkins about coaching agile teams and hearing what she has to say about it and exploring some of these ideas a bit further, because she wrote this book 10 years ago and she hasn't just been sitting around doing nothing for the last 10 years. She had a lot of experience, like a scary amount of experience when she wrote this book. It kind of, that was one of the funny things in the forewords to the book was written about how she was speaking at the Agile conference in 2009, and everyone, there's all this excitement at the conference because this super experienced Agile coach was speaking. And I was thinking, super experienced Agile coach in 2009? How many of us had more than 4 or 5 years of experience in 2009? If she was crazy experienced in 2009, wait until you meet Liz Adkins 2020, coming here in 2 weeks. That's going to be fun. And then a month from now, we will be talking about Heidi Helfand's book, Dynamic Reteaming, second edition. Now in bookstores. Meanwhile, while you're waiting, because I know time passes slowly, especially for those of us who are quarantined, you're sitting on the couch, you're done playing with the cats, you've already played too much video games. I don't know, maybe drop into your favorite podcasting app and rate and review this podcast. You know, that would be a thing you could do. Another thing you could do, and this is a thing you couldn't do last week. You couldn't even do this 2 days ago, but you can do this now. Another thing you can do is, if you got a Kindle, you can now buy Justina's book on Amazon. And so if you've been holding out because you didn't want to download the PDF from which... You know, the PDF from Lean Pub is cool because the book was originally designed by a really talented illustrator, and so it's lovely. The original book is lovely, but I think they've done a fine job of converting it so that it works and still has a lot of the original charm and all of the impact and great ideas and tools of the original in the Kindle version. So go out and buy that and leave a review on Amazon, of course, because Justina's ego needs it.
Yes, my ego needs it. Do it for me.
and also, we're doing something new. I talked about it a little bit earlier. We're going to keep going because
we're going to... Yes, it's 1 hour 20, I think. Are we going for 2 hours today? Oh my God, I should have eaten something.
Because we've got stuff to say and it's just for the adults. So we're going to go into a different room. Not literally going into a different room. But we're going to be right here. But we're going to keep going. And we're going to share the things that we don't necessarily share with everybody. These are, you know, the stuff we want to keep in the family. And so we're going to be using a functionality which is kind of built into Patreon, which is the way in which we're trying to pay for this podcast. Right now, we're paying for this podcast. You know, we're paying for the studio right now. It's coming out of our pockets, indirectly. It's coming out of the company that we own. And we're hoping that we can get to a point where the podcast pays for itself from people who appreciate what we're doing and want to buy us a cup of coffee from time to time. And then you can do that through Patreon. And we want to give something a little back. And so we're going to try doing this. There's a feature in Patreon that allows for access to, so you can subscribe to a podcast feed that's only available to people with permission through the Patreon app. And so we're going to give that permission. We're going to give that access to the after show to everyone who donates $5 a month or more. I mean, if you donate more, you're awesome. You're really awesome. We've got a $20 subscriber in New Zealand. Bless you. I sent her a book. I hope she got it. But $5, that's it. That's $5, that's like a frappuccino. You give us a frappuccino a month, and we will give you
juicy information.
Yeah, more of us, which is a good thing.
Maybe we should pay listeners, you know.
So if you want more, that's how you do it. There'll also be a link in the show notes. And otherwise, be back here in 2 weeks. It's going to be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.